This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Oil is a coming from deep down below. Fishies and shrimpies have nowhere to go. Can't seem to stop it. It's out of control. Corporate catastrophe is running the show.
Black oil, millions of years old, gushes out of a gash in the Gulf of Mexico. One of the world's largest companies, BP, formerly British Petroleum, says it's 1,000 barrels a day, then 5,000. Satellite photos suggest 25,000 a day. In a closed session to Congress, BP admits they don't know. It could be 40 to 60,000 barrels a day. The governor of Louisiana prepares for 100,000 barrels. The spill is really a man-made volcano underwater. I'm Alex Smith. This accident taps a primeval fear in the human mind. Something dark and uncontrollable rushes up out of the belly of the earth, poisoning the global oceans. Could that really happen? Madness ensues. Right-wing radio's Rush Limbaugh suggests the giant rig Deepwater Horizon was bombed by environmentalists. Others say a North Korean submarine did it. During two administrations, BP lulled regulators to sleep with assurances and campaign contributions. All that dirt will leak out, too. Meanwhile, 20,000 feet below the Gulf waters, the giant Macondo field spurts out a relentless wave of fossil carbon suspected to equal a new Exxon Valdez spill every 3 days. So many victims, so many tales to tell. In this Radio EcoShock report, you'll hear from the activist who knew this was coming. Ricky Ott, marine biologist, fisherwoman, and the conscience of Valdez, Alaska, checks in from New Orleans. Antonio Yuhas, oil researcher from Global Exchange, introduces us to BP and its lobby in Washington. Peak oil guru Richard Heinberg looks at the big picture impact. And former Shell executive Anita Burke finds the inside track and the real culprits. We'll end with a new song, Corporate Catastrophe, written about the spill by Dana Pearson and heard first on your Radio EcoShock. From New Orleans, we're joined by Dr. Ricky Ott, marine biologist and former commercial fisherperson in Alaska. She was among the first to see the Exxon Valdez tanker slick, became a leading activist, and wrote two books, Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, and Sound Truth and Corporate Myths, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. Ricky, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the invite.
I realize you have just arrived in New Orleans, but what are your first impressions?
Well, the first impression is that I need to get to the coast as fast as possible. So we are heading out to where the real impacts are today. There's just a feel in New Orleans like, you know, could be business as usual. We don't know. I mean, it's not the all-engulfing, all-consuming terror and agony that is experienced in these coastal communities that are going to be directly impacted by the oil.
You spent 20 years studying the impact of the Exxon Valdez spill, and am I correct in saying the oil damage is still continuing there?
We have herring fishermen who are not able to fish their permits. Their $300,000 permits have completely devalued to zero. They owe annual payments, and there's accumulating debt on those permits. The herring fisheries are closed indefinitely, and so fishermen today are incurring losses from something that happened 21 years ago. Other fisheries have recovered, like pink salmon, but that one is really dragging down the economy and our fishermen still to this day.
Well, I've read your books, and it seems to me that you are saying that once oil reaches land, it can't really be cleaned up.
I'm still sticking to that. Now, the sweet Louisiana crude that has spilled here has a higher portion of light ends, or a fraction of oil that dissolves more readily into the water column, evaporates more readily, and will be easier to break down with bacteria. Now, having said that, I'm still talking in the order of decades. This is not a fast process. In Alaska, scientists are saying of the oil that's still on our beaches, probably another 20 years, they don't know. So we're looking at 40 to 50 years in Alaska. That process might be hastened a little bit here, but really we can put hair mats and, boom material, but there's still going to be a lot of dissolved oil, and the dissolved oil in the water column will be killing fish eggs, shellfish eggs, like the shrimp eggs, clams, oyster eggs, and larvae. And the killing will not just stop this year. There will be generations of harm because of this spill.
As we speak, the slick has not yet reached the shore. BP is taking some credit, claiming their use of dispersants is working. What are these chemicals, and what is their environmental impact?
These are chemical products that are designed by the oil companies to literally break apart the oil, sheen on the surface, or in the water column, break up the oil into smaller droplets that then are diluted by the ocean volume of seawater. So the solution to pollution is dilution. That's literally what dispersants do. However, dispersant use also involves a trade-off, because any painter knows, or like people who took high school chemistry, like dissolves like. So like we're talking oil. So to dissolve oil, you have to use an oil-based product. And these dispersants are therefore by nature hazardous and toxic. The very first generation of dispersants that came out after the Torrey Canyon spill in 1967 were actually more toxic than the oil. And they were shelled. I actually did research on some of these dispersants. And there were several, now we're several generations later in chemical products. But by nature, these chemicals are hazardous. They contain solvents. In and of themselves, they kill marine life with dissolved oil. What we're looking at is a toxic hit in the water column of everything that's there. It's a trade-off of trying to minimize the amount of oil that makes landfall. Dispersants are not 100% effective. Probably what's going on, and I haven't seen any current maps, but it's current. I know that one of the towns released a bunch of water from the reservoir to try to push the oil offshore. I wouldn't necessarily, it's all dispersants at this time. Dispersants are not 100% effective, like I said, and we're going to probably see a hit in the water column plus, a hit on land when that happens.
I realize this is all kind of a guessing game at this point because it's such a unique situation, but are you personally optimistic that BP's collector dome will work? Their idea of dropping this giant device on top of the well and soaking some oil out of it.
What amazes me about the oil industry is that everything is an experiment. You would think that we as a society, if we're going to sign off contingency plans, we fell for this in Alaska. We believed that the oil industry could clean up after themselves if there was an accident. They had these state and federal approved contingency plans, on paper. It looks like it works, but it turns out when these big spills really happen, there's a lot of guesswork going on, and I have no idea. I know the industry is trying. It's a big mess. Everything is going to take time. I guess we just have to wait and see.
Right. Well, this is playing out in Canada now because the same companies want to drill up in the Beaufort Sea, and they don't want to have any of the safety mechanisms. They were trying to get the government to drop that. Do you see some impact on Arctic offshore drilling coming out of this accident?
Well, what I hope is, Exxon Valdez shut down the industry surge to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's what was going on in 1988, and it probably would have been opened by our Congress in 1989 had it not been for Exxon Valdez. And what I'm hopeful now is that this oil spill here, this leak, really, in the Gulf, will cause some sense and some sanity in our energy legislation. By that, I mean, if you look at the whole energy package, and the cost of global climate change and the global climate crisis, really what we need to do is transition off fossil fuels. So I am hoping that we see a slowing down of outer continental shelf oil and gas leasing, and at a minimum, review of all the oil spill prevention and response laws, of all the other laws where industry has carved out for itself exemptions or weakening, been able to weaken regulations. And I'd like to see all of that on the table, what we've done, and it all tightened back up before we go anywhere.
Ricky, your second book, Not One Drop, focused on the harsh damage happening to the local communities, not just the economic loss, but fights and depressions and so on. What can Gulf communities do to help themselves?
Well, this is actually one of the main reasons I'm down here, is to help the communities, because we wasted a lot of time in Cordova hoping that Exxon would take care of us, hoping that the state or the federal government would take care of us. And it wasn't really until the fish runs collapsed in 1993 as a delayed, when the babies of the year did not materialize 3 and 4 years later, there was a delayed ecosystem collapse. When that ecosystem collapse happened, we realized we had to take care of ourselves. And I'm hoping to help the local community down here realize that even though President Obama has said, we will hold BP accountable, President Obama has no idea that the laws will work against him to make that promise real. It will be impossible. The laws will only hold the oil industry accountable for a very small percent of the harm. So what I'm hoping to do is go down and let people know this. Let people know that our fisheries are still closed 21 years later. Let people know you better have a plan B. Hold peer listening circles where the people sit in circle. And yes, they share their grief, they share their fears, but then they say, what can we do? And these peer listening circles were actually devised by Dr. Steve Picou out of Mobile, Alabama, in studying Cordova as a case study. And these peer listening circles actually help to reduce some of the stress and trauma and switch people from the victim mode into the survivor mode. And that's what I'm hoping to do down here with community education.
As we wrap up, do you have other news or views you would like to pass along?
Well, if people have ideas or suggestions, please contact me through the website rikiott.com. My handler, Lisa Marie, another spill victim, is down here with me, and I'm going to be here for 3 weeks, and I hope to be as useful as possible to the communities that will be impacted.
Our guest has been Dr. Ricky Ott, marine biologist, author, and super expert on oil spills. Ricky, I know you're flooded with media requests. I've seen you on CNN several times. Thank you for taking the time for Radio EcoShock.
And also, Radio EcoShock Canada people, I will be in Kitimat on May 29th for the solidarity celebration of people standing against the Enbridge pipeline. Hope to see you there.
Absolutely. We've got a pipeline to stop here for the same kind of reasons. Thank you again, Ricky.
You bet.
This is Radio EcoShock with Joel Plaskett rocking in the background.
Oil is a coming from deep down below. Try, can't seem to stop it. The it's out of control. Corporate catastrophe is running.
Our next guest, Antonio Yuhas, has been following the oil industry for San Francisco-based human rights group Global Exchange. In Britain's Observer newspaper of May 2nd, Antonio writes, "Another fatal accident from BP is a surprise to no one." Antonio, to set the stage, just how big is BP, the company formerly known as British Petroleum?
BP is one of the largest corporations in the world. Its revenues make it larger than most of the countries on the planet. If it was based in the United States, it would be the third largest corporation in the United States after Walmart and Exxon. It's a behemoth and has been for many, many years.
So their gross revenues would be in the hundreds of billions of dollars?
Yeah, its revenues last year in U.S. dollars were $327 billion, give or take.
That's pretty big. Well, according to the Financial Times, high oil prices gave the company's oil and gas unit a 94% rise in profits to $8.3 billion. That kind of money can buy a lot of influence in Washington. What do we know about BP's lobby efforts?
And I think it surprises most people outside of the United States to understand how large of a lobby presence even non-U.S. companies have here. So BP is one of the top 20 lobbying bodies before the U.S. government. Last year alone, they spent $16 million lobbying the federal government. That doesn't include state-level lobbying. And that's $6 million more than the year before, which itself was also a record-breaking year. So they've definitely been trying to better their image and better the perception among regulators in the United States by spending liberally on lobbying dollars. Until this year, in the United States, we had a limit on how much companies could spend on campaigns. BP was still among the top oil companies contributing to campaigns in the United States elections. We're all now pretty afraid of what the impact is going to be on the impact of the Supreme Court's ruling on Citizen United, which essentially now opens the door completely to the same type of money we see spent on lobbying to now be spent on campaigns. So I would anticipate that BP, particularly in light of the explosion, is going to now start matching those lobbying, the campaign spending dollars with the same amount they spend on lobbying.
So if you give them a break on regulation, you might get some campaign money, and if you don't, they may fund your opposition.
Yes.
Oh, that's ugly. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the investigation of BP's Texas City refinery accident, that fatal blowout in 2005?
Yes, that was the last major U.S. workplace incident in the United States. It had been the worst in 15 years when it happened in 2005. 15 workers were killed, about 180 were injured, And the results of the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which is an independent federal agency that investigated the incident, found BP completely to blame, and the cause of the blame was massive cost-cutting, that BP, while it was experiencing its highest profits in history, was cutting 25% cuts in 1999 and 2005 across the board at all of its U.S. refineries. The investigation found that they were complacent in security, that they were lacking in training, that they were essentially lacking across the board in their attention paid to security and safety and the well-being of their operations. It was a truly damning report, actually, that came out. BP was found guilty of criminal charges, paid a hefty fine. There was definitely changes in the leadership in BP as a result. However, you know, as you said in your introduction, while it's sad to say it, unfortunately, it wasn't surprising that when the next great major oil industry explosion happened in the United States, it was once again BP.
This whole breakdown reminds me so much of deregulation on Wall Street. It seems like the industry sets the standards, such as they are, until greed blows the whole thing up. Do you see similarities?
The 8 years of the Bush administration were really an unprecedented party for the oil industry. We had the oiliest government in U.S. history with the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, many other key officials coming directly out of the oil industry. Both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice had actually more experience running oil companies when they took office than they did working for the federal government. And the industry basically was able to stop lobbying and start legislating. They were completely within and of the administration. So we saw an opening up of opportunities for places to drill in the United States, a lack of regulatory oversight and enforcement. We saw subsidies and tax breaks to the industry that really helped fill the bottom lines of this industry and these companies, and a free-for-all. And I think we are paying the consequence of that free-for-all now with this explosion, frankly. And, you know, the Obama administration has been better and has certainly responded to this crisis in a way that we had hoped they would have responded earlier, which was to reverse itself on opening up new offshore areas of the U.S. coast to drilling. The administration has definitely jumped right in and is on the ground in the sites of where the spill is both taking place and where it's washed ashore, which is across four states now. And hopefully we're going to see a regulatory response by the Obama administration, not just harsh words, and to really start rolling back significantly the liberal tendencies of the Bush administration.
This whole deep water drilling, it brings up the whole issue of climate change again, because we've got these massive oil fields. We think that were safely buried, the carbon was safely buried miles below the surface of the earth. Now we're going to bring it out, and whether we leak it into the Gulf or whether we successfully burn it in our SUVs, either way, aren't we just inviting more climate change by doing deep water drilling?
Well, drilling at depths of greater than 500 feet releases methane, a greenhouse gas, estimated about 25 times more intensive, carbon intensive than CO2, far more destructive to the environment. And these rigs in the Gulf that used to be drilling at 30 to 120 feet are now drilling at 1,000 feet, 5,000 feet. The rig that exploded was drilling at 18,000 feet. BP has a 25,000-foot well out in the U.S. Gulf. We have only begun to appreciate the environmental consequences of this type of offshore drilling. Forget accidents, just the consequences that happened when the drilling is taking place as it should. We know about the release of methane. We know about the release of toxins. We know about the release of all sorts of sediment and toxic-filled sediment through the drilling process, the impact on marine wildlife from the various sonar technology that's used to find the oil fields deep offshore. Then there is the massive network of pipes involved to bring the oil back to shore. These are miles and miles and miles of pipes that stream into the Gulf. And actually, just 2 weeks ago, an Exxon oil tanker snagged a massive pipeline owned by Chevron and leaked 18,000 gallons of oil into the Gulf, and that was just preceding this explosion. The oil drilling also causes coastal erosion. That erosion opens up the door to make it much worse when storms come through. So when Katrina hit, the impact was significantly worse because there wasn't a natural buffer. Moreover, the coastal erosion exposes the oil pipelines. So you now have what used to be underground pipelines are now above ground and are being much more, again, themselves prone to accidents. So even when everything's working as it should, you have a highly polluting, highly dangerous, toxic methane leaking industry. And then, of course, when accident occurs, I think the average person doesn't quite appreciate, or if you don't have your head stuck in this, how massive these operations are. The drilling that BP is doing, for example, its deepest well at 25,000 feet is deeper down than Mount Everest is up, and there is equipment that is being put out into the ocean that these facilities are as big as the Eiffel Tower. They are enormous, and they are technologically unprecedented in what's needed to keep them going. And then when an accident happens, it's a massive accident. So it's now being estimated that this oil spill is ultimately likely to be worse than the Exxon Valdez spill, making it the worst oil spill in history.
Tell us briefly about your work and your book, The Tyranny of Oil.
Yeah, I released The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It in 2008, based on my analysis of the industry and, most importantly, its relationship to the Bush administration and watching this industry build itself to become just hands down the wealthiest industry the world has ever known, having access to more capital than any other industry. For a time there in the early 2000s, the banking sector could challenge the oil sector in terms of its wealth, but then the banking sector crashed, and then the oil industry helped push the price of a barrel of oil up so dramatically that the amount of wealth that flew into the coffers of this industry is literally just unprecedented. In 2003, Exxon earned the highest profits of any corporation in world history. It then topped them in 2004. It topped them in 2005. It topped them in 2006, 2007. They were again up in 2008. 2009 saw a dip, but it looks like we're back up. The company that I follow the most closely, Chevron, like most of the industry in 2009, because of the fall of the price of oil, its profits about halved last year. But already in the first quarter of this year, it's doubled its profits from the first quarter of last year. So this industry just has an enormous amount of wealth, and I was very concerned about how that wealth was being translated into very aggressive political power, leading to environmental destruction, social destruction, but also war, one of the large consequences of that power. And my book was an analysis of that wealth and that power. It then led me to focus in on one company with this wonderful human rights organization that I work for, Global Exchange, to look at Chevron and to focus on campaigning around one company to see if that campaigning, pulling together communities affected by and fighting back against Chevron's operations all around the world, all across the country, could focus our energy on one company as a way to bring changes to the entire global oil industry.
This is Radio EcoShock. You have just heard from Antonio Yuhas, author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. She's the director of the Chevron program at globalexchange.org. Thank you so much, Antonia.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
A mile and a half under where humans can't go. We've punctured a hole into what we don't know. The oil is escaping all over the place. Is this the beginning, the end of our race?
Here is just a spoonful from the net. Jason Leopold at truthout.org reports on a whistleblower, a former oil contractor claiming BP broke the law and its own procedures, as it did in the deadly 2005 Texas City oil refinery explosion. Another corporate accident waiting to happen, perhaps on BP's other giant deepwater platform, Atlantis. Excellent investigative journalism. Check it out by Jason Leopold. Last week's EcoShock guest, Nicholas Kozloff, has blistering blog entries on the spill at his blog at nicholaskozloff.com. The black history of BP and its cozy relationship with U.S. regulators. Find active discussion threads in the drumbeat postings at theoildrum.com and thedailycost.com. More continuing Gulf spill coverage at gulflive.com and maps at skytruth.org. The Alabama viewpoint from AL.com, where, for example, Ben Raines tells us a leaked Coast Guard memo fears the deepwater site could release even millions of gallons a day into the Gulf. There are tens of millions of barrels of oil and gas in this deposit, under high pressure, miles deep under the crust, now coming up. In the UK, the Times newspaper reveals BP knew of problems with the blowout preventer 10 years ago when it was installed. Operator Transocean admitted the preventer did not work properly on another rig, the Discoverer Enterprise. Other experts question the faults in the cement work around the wellhead performed by Dick Cheney's former company, Halliburton. The dispersants loaded into the deep ocean and airdropped on the surface may make the Gulf of Mexico history's largest chemical experiment. No one knows the harm coming. Everyone, even the harshest oil critics, hope or pray the BP jerry-rigged containment dome can seal off the very worst. Then we can go on as usual, wrecking the climate and the seas as we drive around. Except the very worst has already happened. Perhaps ocean drilling around the world is an endangered species. I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.